Let it go.
Ottawa Now, all your breaking news and issues that matter to you on News Talk 580 CFRA.
I'm waiting on you, I guess, so I don't take blame.
508, welcome back. Christy Cameron here with you for another hour tonight and lots to come on the show. It's minus 9, feeling like minus 16, getting cooler out there. All right, we've talked coronavirus, we've talked LRT. We've talked Bell Let's Talk, and we'll get to more of those stories coming up. But lost in the shuffle, I think, a bit this week amid all of the news, especially the outbreak news, the teachers' labor strife in Ontario. And it continues. Members of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario have walked off the job for the day today at the Upper Canada District School Board. And that meant no classes for K-8 students. But now it looks like they're going back to the bargaining table. Why? We don't know. My sense is that the mediator thinks something has changed. Hey, maybe now we can hammer out a deal. But we don't know. And yesterday I chatted with Elizabeth Kettle. She's the president of the Ottawa Carleton ETFO. I asked her, are you optimistic about this?
I really hope it is. I'd like to be optimistic and positive and say that, you know what? Great. They're going back to the table. The government's willing to sit down. I really hope this is good news.
But that optimism is measured, as the teachers and the government really don't seem like they've changed their stances. Because I asked her yesterday, okay, well, what concessions are the teachers willing to make? Or do you get the sense that the government is going to bend? And she said this.
I'm just hoping that the government realizes that this is really serious for our teachers, that they really need to see these serious concerns addressed. As I said, like the addressing violence in our schools, like that's a huge issue for our members. I hope that they're looking at it now.
I don't think much has changed. So why is the mediator calling everyone back? I don't know. If no deal is reached next week, ETFO is going to hold walkouts every day, including one in Ottawa on Wednesday, and then there will be a province-wide strike the following day. Paul Calandra is an MPP and government house leader, and he's speaking on behalf of the provincial government on education today. He joins me on the line. Good afternoon.
Hey, Christy, how are you?
I'm great. So they're getting back together. Do you think both sides here are closer to hitting a deal that will make them happy? Could they meet a deal here that will prevent those strikes I'm talking about next week?
Look, I've always been optimistic either the Crown or the teachers were far apart. There's a lot of things that we agree on, but this is honestly just a very, very, very initial first step, and the mediator is bringing us back. So I'm not reading too much into it, but I think ultimately I've never felt that we couldn't reach an agreement with the teacher unions on this. I've never felt that we're that far apart.
I would say from my interviews with both sides on this, I would say you've been pretty far apart. I mean, there are things like full-day kindergarten, for example. The government has said publicly, we're committed to full-day kindergarten, but the union wants that in writing. They want one teacher, one ECE, one early childhood educator. The government, they say, hasn't been willing to put that in writing. And then from their account, they've been saying, well, if you're going to do it, why not just write it down? Has the government changed on that, for example? Have they changed their stance on that?
Well, look, I don't want to prejudge what's happening at the bargaining table because I'm not privy to what is at the bargaining table. We have been very clear on that. It's not something that we're bargaining. It's not something that I've at no point have been told that has ever been on the bargaining table at all during these negotiations. So I'm not sure why you'd bring something to the table that has never been on the table, frankly. But ultimately, look, we've said we want to reach a deal. We have reached a deal with some other of the unions. Granted, it's only two, and there's a lot more that work that has to be done. But I honestly feel we want the same things. It's just that we have obviously a big gap on how we get there. I know that teachers I talk to, they want to be teaching, they want to be in the classroom, and they want to get the best deal for students. We are not that far apart in the sense that we want the same thing. We want our students to have the best possible education that they can have. We respect and want to provide the resources that, that teachers need. We want to respect them in terms of compensation, and I think we can get there. But obviously, we've had a no sense in saying otherwise. We've had a challenge to this point, but I'm cautiously optimistic. The mediator has brought us back, and that's where I think parents want it resolved. They want it resolved at the bargaining table, and we're ready to do that.
If no deal is reached, as I mentioned, there are more walkouts planned. This is obviously a big issue that parents are grappling with,
for sure.
As you know. Yeah. How much does that crank up the pressure?
I don't want to say anything other than the fact that I hear it from parents myself. They're starting to get frustrated. When their kids are home from school, they start to worry about, are they missing classes? It hurts parents financially because they have to make arrangements, especially in the K to grade eight. Levels. There is some fear and there's some worry and there's some frustration, and they are starting to ask, please get back to the table and get things resolved. I think we all want that. I think both sides, whether it's the Crown or the union, feel the same way. And even the teachers I've spoke to, it's tough on them as well, right? A lot of the teachers are two teacher families. So when they lose a day's pay, it hurts them. It hurts them not only because they're not teaching kids, but it hurts them financially. They also have bills that they have to pay. So I think ultimately we taxpayers, and when I say taxpayers, I include teachers as well in this. They want us to get to the table, solve what our issues are, and get the kids back in the classroom permanently, and make sure whatever happens that we come out of this with a system that gives our kids the best results possible so that they have the best future available to them.
Do you think we're at a real risk right now of this turning into something longer, a protracted strike, not just these one-day events?
Again, Chris, I mean, it sounds like a broken record, but I remain optimistic on this one, because when you talk to us in terms of the Crown, and when you talk to teachers, we want the same thing, and the differences really aren't that far apart. The government, or the Crown, anyway, has been able to make agreements with a couple of unions to avoid strike action, and I think we can do it. It's a positive sign, but it's really an initial step that we're coming. The mediator has brought us both back to the table, and maybe I'm unique, but I'm optimistic that
right.
we can get something done here.
But I'm sure you can concede that you understand why people are not optimistic when we're seeing
100%.
This level. When we're seeing across the board, all of the unions are involved in some type of labor action. I'm sure, sir, you can understand why people
absolutely.
Are going, okay, you may be optimistic, but I'm not.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And ultimately, the proof is in the pudding for whether it's parents, for students, when it comes right down to it, the teachers want to be teaching, the Crown wants our teachers teaching, the students want to be there, and taxpayers want us to solve this. And I think it's incumbent on us. The patience will run out from parents and all taxpayers, and they are going to want us to come to a resolution. We always have, regardless of who has been in government, regardless of the political stripe. We've had these challenges, but we've always come to a resolution, and teachers have gone back into the classroom, and students have gotten the education that they deserve, and we will accomplish that now. And I'm hoping that it'll be sooner rather than later. And it's a good, as I said, a good first step. The mediator has called us back, but I do get the frustration.
And if you don't reach something, like if this continues, and it let's say that we're not going your optimistic route here, let's go more the pessimistic route. The labor unrest continues, the mediator calls everyone back, things don't work out because you're not seeing eye to eye, and you know, no one is happy. When does the government make another move here? Does the government look at legislating them back to work?
There's an outside commission that tells us ultimately when the student's year is in jeopardy. It's not something that the government makes a decision on its own. We take the advice of others with respect to when kids' education becomes jeopardized by our inability to collectively come to an agreement. So we're not anywhere near that right now. While the strikes are challenging and have been difficult for parents and students alike, we're not there yet. And I choose to be optimistic that we're coming back to the table with one of our union one of the unions.
And that's a last step. The back-to-work legislation is a last step.
It's not even something that we're even remotely thinking about right now. As I said, it's something that we want to negotiate an agreement. Ultimately, if we can negotiate a collective agreement with our teachers, it's better for students, it's better for taxpayers, and it's ultimately better for teachers because we will have resolved some of the issues that will ensure that our kids have the best possible education. And I think we can do it. We've done it with two other unions, and we can do it with the rest of them. I know we can.
Paul Calandra, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Christy.
That is the MPP, Paul Calandra, Government House Leader, speaking on behalf of the provincial government on the education file today. 518.
News Talk 580 CFRA's $1,000 Minute. Brought to you by Alpine Credits. Homeowners get approved.
All right, we've got Brian on the line. Hey, Brian.
Hi. How are you, Christy?
I'm good. Were you listening yesterday when we gave away $1,000?
I was.
Yeah. Pretty crazy thing that there might be a child in Ottawa one day with my middle name, right? I'm buying people off, Brian.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Can you bribe me?
I guess we'll...
Do you have any children that you could rename, a pet even?
No.
No. Okay, I see. You want to just play it fair and clean. That's fine. That's fine. All right, I got 10 questions here. If you get them all right, we'll give you $1,000. If not, $10 a question. We have to take the first answer you give, so don't blurt it out if you don't know. And when the buzzer goes off, that's it. Okay?
Sounds good.
Here we go, Brian. The new coronavirus originated in which Chinese city?
Well...
Who is Canada's foreign affairs minister?
Champagne.
Rawlson King is a city councillor. What is his ward?
Rockcliffe.
Comedian Mary Walsh is known for starring on which Canadian comedy show?
Pass.
City Council has voted to declare a state of emergency today on what?
Homelessness.
Who is Ottawa's medical officer of health?
Ottawa. Pass.
Who are the Ottawa Senators playing tonight?
Pass.
Which NBA team did Kobe Bryant play for?
LA Lakers.
Who is Ontario's health minister?
Ontario Elliott.
Today we're raising funds and awareness for mental health. What is the day called?
Bell, Let's Talk.
Comedian Mary Walsh is known for starring on which Canadian comedy show?
Corner Gas.
Who are the Ottawa Senators playing Friday night?
Washington.
All right. Pretty good. You said Wuhan, $10. You got it. François-Philippe Champagne, you got it. It was not Corner Gas. That was a good guess, but no, it's this hour has 22 minutes. Rawlson King is the city councillor for Rideau-Rockcliffe. You got that one. Homelessness, you're right. You missed the medical officer of health, that is Dr. Vera Etches. But you knew the Washington Capitals are playing the Sens. You knew Kobe played for the LA Lakers. And Christine Elliott is the health minister. And today is Bell Let's Talk. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 for $80.
Not bad.
Not bad at all. Congratulations. Stay on the line, my friend.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening. 529. Quick break for the news, and we'll be right back.
News Talk 580 CFRA's $1,000 Minute. Brought to you by Alpine Credits. Homeowners get approved.
Toast to the ones here today. Toast to the ones that we lost on the way. Cause the drinks bring back all the memories.
Now back to Ottawa Now on News Talk 580 CFRA.
537. Welcome back. It is Bell Let's Talk Day, and throughout the program this afternoon, we've been talking to various people, champions of mental health, people that have opened up about their own experiences. Every time you tweet today using the hashtag Bell Let's Talk, Bell donates 5 cents towards Canadian mental health initiatives. You can also send a text if you're a Bell customer, watch the official video on Instagram and YouTube, or use the Snapchat filter if you're a snapper. I know I'm not on there. I feel a little bit too old for Snapchat, if I'm being honest. I had it for a little bit, and then I was really just my sister that was on there. So I thought, if I'm using Snapchat just to snap to my sister, why don't I just send her a text message? David's laughing.
How old are you? 40?
Do I have to answer that?
40 is too old for
what? I'm 29. I'm 29 years old. Right. And I know some of our listeners may find that surprising. People often think I'm older based on my voice. I am 29.
You think you're too old for Snapchat? You might be too old for TikTok. I don't even know what a TikTok
Snapchat is.
Snapchat? Come on.
But you know, on a day like today, go and do it. use the Bell Snapchat filter, Bell Let's Talk, or Facebook if you're on Facebook. Today is a really important day to open up this conversation, to break down the stigma of talking about mental health. Because people are going through something and you never know what that is. Could be depression, could be anxiety. In the case of Anita Manley, she was struggling with schizoaffective bipolar disorder for many years. She was hospitalized 7 times beginning in her early 20s. At 43 years old, she lost contact with all of her friends and family and found herself living in her car. And she joins me now on the line. Anita, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Christy. It's good to be here.
Tell me about the time that you were struggling with this back in the day when you learned that you did have schizoaffective bipolar disorder.
Well, it sort of came upon gradually. I started having delusions starting, and I didn't really realize what they were, in about 2000. But things got really bad in 2008, and due to the delusions that I was having that I totally believed to be true, along with my severe and persistent mental illness, I lost my ability to parent my then 2 teenage daughters, my ability to work, my ability to concentrate on paying bills, and then eventually I lost my housing. So I refused treatment at the hospital and was released to the streets, where I remained homeless, as you mentioned, for 3 years, living in shelters, and as you indicated, even in my car. But then I was fortunate enough, against my will, to arrive at the Royal, and with great life-changing treatment that I received there over 7 months, I basically became a lot healthier. So I'm very grateful to the Royal for that.
When you say it was against your will, what do you mean?
Well, they took me in, and what they do is they put you on a form, which basically means you can't leave. You have to accept the treatment that they give you. So I was very fortunate to be what they call formed for a long, long period of time, like over a couple of months. And eventually, I finally accepted the treatment and listened to my doctor and decided to take my medication and challenge the delusions, my delusional beliefs.
What were your delusional beliefs? Why was it you didn't want to get treated?
Well, I really believed that people who I knew but I could not see, and they weren't around, were communicating with me through other people, including my children, my family, my friends, strangers, you know, through these transceivers that I thought that everybody had in their ears. So it's very confusing to try to explain, but it wasn't as though I was hearing voices. I could hear exactly what, if it was you, for example, I would hear exactly what you're saying to me, but I would believe that somebody else was delivering that message to me.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it was terrifying. It was very confusing. It was very frustrating, and I was really very angry at these people who I couldn't see that I knew and couldn't have access to. So it was for many, many years. As I said, it started in 2000, and then my life totally fell apart in 2008. But in 2011, I received life-saving treatment at the Royal, and I changed my life around. So I managed to reconnect in 2011 with my daughters and build relationships with my 2 daughters and the rest of my family, my mom and my brother and other relatives. And then I worked really, really hard over the last 8 years at creating a new solid support network where I get and give support. And the number one game changer for me has been volunteering. I find that giving back and helping others helps me to stay well as well. So I volunteer in the Women's Mental Health Program at the Royal, offering a journaling as a wellness tool group.
That must have been a really emotional reunion with your children. After going through what you were, after not really knowing what was going on, and obviously at that time, Anita, you didn't know that these delusions were not real. So then to actually be better and to be in a clearer state of mind, meeting with your children again, that must have been a very big moment for you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was very emotional. My youngest daughter came to the hospital, actually, when we reconnected, and Yeah, you know, I mean, it was a very tearful reunion. Yeah, because for 3 years we hadn't had any contact. So it was, you know, and those were formative years for my youngest daughter. My oldest daughter and I just reconnected at her wedding in 2018.
Wow.
Which was wonderful. We were estranged for over 10 years. So we eventually reconnected, and she lives on Vancouver Island. So, yeah, anyway, it's wonderful to have both of them back in my life.
What do you want people listening right now to know about this disorder, schizoaffective bipolar disorder?
Well, I want people to know that even with a severe and persistent mental illness like I had, it's possible to recover. You know, there's lots and lots of hope out there, and people can and do recover and go on to lead fulfilling lives. I have a very fulfilling life right now. I met a wonderful man 5 years ago tomorrow, and we have a beautiful life together. I am reconnected with my daughters, and I have meaningful, purposeful volunteer work that I do, give back to the community, and I lead a very, very happy, fulfilling life.
Not everyone wants that help, and even you yourself, you did not want that help. You were frightened. You didn't want to go into treatment. Do you have any advice, and not medical advice, but any words of wisdom for people that are listening right now and may have a loved one that is not accepting of treatment on how they might go ahead and proceed with that?
That's really tough, you know, because I didn't listen to anyone. I believed those delusions so wholeheartedly, and I thought nobody else was right, and I would, you know, they would argue with me. I guess, you know, try to remain an ally of the person who refuses treatment and listen without judgment. And I mean, if you do have to bring them in for psychiatric evaluation against their will, you know, it might not be such a bad thing to do. I know that's really, it's really, really hard on the family to do that. And it's often enforced by the police, and the police come and take you to the hospital. In my case, they showed up at my door and tackled me, handcuffed me, and I was taken in the back of the police car, and that's the last time I saw all my possessions, including my cat, and my kids were living with their dad full-time at that time. So, yeah, it can be, you know, a very traumatic experience, and it's hard for parents or loved ones to see that happen to someone that they love so dearly, but in my case, eventually, I got the help I so desperately needed, and I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful to the Royal for keeping me there for 7 months, you know?
Yeah. Well, Anita, I'm happy that you have your life back, and thank you so much for your courage, for being candid and sharing that with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
That is Anita Manley joining us, talking about life with schizoaffective bipolar disorder. What a struggle for her. Eventually being hospitalized against her will, but now leading a much better life, being able to share that story with others. Really powerful. 546.
So why don't we go out and get a drink in the West End, smoke a cigarette and talk about it? You're listening to Ottawa Now on News Talk 580 CFRA.
552. Before we go, I want to leave you with one last story from Michael Landsberg of TSN. He's somebody who's been a champion for mental health. He made a documentary called Darkness and Hope, Depression, Sports, and Me. And he's been a partner with Bell Let's Talk for many years now, talking about his own battle with depression and the need to get help. And we had a really poignant conversation earlier in the show, so I wanted to play a small excerpt of it for you here. This is just a snippet of what we talked about earlier. I was asking him what steps and tools really helped him in his own fight with mental illness.
If you're sick enough, then you have to say, I will do anything to get better. Because if you're sick enough, then you're really not living. You're alive, but you're not living. And if I ask the question, and this is kind of how I start conversations with people who say, hey, I don't know, am I sick or, you know, with the illness depression, or am I just having a bad time in my life? And, you know, one of the basic questions is, if you had to live the way you feel right now for the rest of your life, and when I say right now, I mean today or this week or this month, just in general, if you had to live this way the rest of your life, could you accept it? Mm. If the answer is no, then you've got to pursue help. But help doesn't mean, okay, And I hear this attitude all the time. People say, okay, I don't believe in medication, or I'm not going to talk about this. You, if you're sick enough, you have to say every single treatment imaginable is still on the table. I will do anything to get better because nothing is worse than where I am right now. So having said that, medication is what gave me my life back. But I'm not here being an advocate for medication. I'm saying medication is a treatment that you have to say is a possibility. There's all kinds of different forms of therapy. There's cognitive behavioral therapy that you can do on your own on the internet. There is electroconvulsive therapy, obviously, a big leap from going online and doing CBT and then going to the hospital and getting shocked. But my point is that these are all viable treatments. You know, there's new drugs. There's ketamine, which is a club drug, which has saved people's lives. There's magnetic stimulation, where they put this big magnet up to the side of your head, and somehow it jumbles what's inside your brain, and some people have gotten relief. Do anything to get better.
You also have a story that you've written about your friend Luke, who died by suicide. And I know it's incredibly painful to talk about, but I think these are worthwhile stories. Can you tell us a little bit about your friend Luke and why you chose to write about him on sicknotweek.com?
You know, that's thank you for asking. And yeah, sure. I mean, it makes me sad to think about Luke, and it's painful, but the value in talking about it, and not to insert myself into the stories and make like he was my best friend. I never met him when he was well. I was walking my dog one day. He died about a year and a half ago. So this would have been about, say, 3 years ago. I'm walking my dog, and a woman says to me, "Are you Michael Landsberg?" And I say, "Yeah." And she says, "Oh, well, my name is Lee Sklar. My husband, Luke Sklar, is in CAMH right now, but he follows you on Twitter. Like, I do a video blog every day." And he said, you know, he'd like to meet you when he gets out. And I said, great. So one day on the street, I saw Luke. I knew it was Luke because I could tell from his walk that he was sick. He was just, it was like he didn't want to get to wherever he was going. I could tell from his eyes because he looked so pained and lifeless. And so we started talking and we became friends. And I realized that there was a huge amount of me in him and a huge amount of him in me, that we had real parallels. And he and I, you know, struck up a friendship where we would communicate mostly by text or email every single day. I would just, you know, send him an email that said, "Hey, dude, how are you?" And I lived with his ups and downs with him. And he was hospitalized because the treatments that he was doing were no longer working. He went to Sunnybrook Hospital. I actually gave a speech in Sunnybrook Hospital, and he came down from the psych ward to hear me speak. I love the guy. He was funny. He was clever. And he wrote something, Christy, that was maybe for me the greatest mirror that I could hold up to myself. He said to me one day, he said, "I have to accept the fact that I'm never going to be the Luke that I was, the person who had a bounce in his step, the person that had a sense of humor, the person that could make people feel better about themselves just from being around me. I have to accept the fact that that person is gone, and it's really difficult." And I thought, oh my God, that is 100% me. When I'm having a bad day, when I'm struggling, that is my worst fear and my worst nightmare, that I have lost who I was. And so we went through for a year and a half. We talked, virtually every day. And he got out of Sunnybrook, and then he went back. And by coincidence, because I've only spoken at Sunnybrook twice, I went back to give a speech. And I said to him, "Can you come down and see me?" And he said, "No, they won't let me out. They think I'm a risk to myself," which is, you know, obviously not a good sign. He sent me an email that morning. He said, "Good luck tonight." I went in. The next morning, he sent me an email that said, "I hope it went well." And then the next morning, I got an email from his wife saying that he had taken his life in the hospital. Uh-huh. And it was for me, the closest I have come to 100% relating to somebody else's experience, more than anyone else I ever met. And it's the kind of tragedy that necessitates action.
Michael Landsberg of TSN talking about his own story, his friend Luke, who died by suicide. A really powerful moment on the air earlier, so we wanted to bring that to you once more. Before we close the show, we'll be back tomorrow from 2 to 6. Thank you for participating in Bell Let's Talk today. If you texted, if you watched a video, if you took part in any way, thank you so much. And thank you for your emails. I've had a lot of people writing in about their own experiences today. I do read the emails if you want to get in touch anytime. Ottawa Now at CFRA.com. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Talk to you then.